Welcome to a special bonus episode of Good Food on KCRW. The Food Book Fair recently came to downtown Los Angeles from March 2nd through the 4th. Last week, we shared some highlights from the fair, and this week, we're sharing the second and final part. First up is a panel called The Food Hustle, moderated by our former producer, Jillian Ferguson. She's joined by a group of writers, photographers, and creatives for a great discussion on making a career in food media.
Hi, everyone. If you're just joining us, welcome to Food Book Fair Los Angeles, and thank you for joining us. We are going to get started with our next panel, The Food Hustle, moderated by the extraordinary writer, producer, Jillian Ferguson. And she'll let the other panelists introduce themselves. And without further ado, I'll let her take it away.
Thank you. So I am going to force these panelists to answer my least favorite question, which is, what do you do? As someone who is quote-unquote multi-hyphenate myself, I never know how to answer this question. So Nick, maybe you start us off.
All right. So this is actually a really hard one. So I write for the San Francisco Chronicle. I'm a columnist there. I am also a cookbook author now. In October, I have my first book coming out. And I photograph food. And I write about it on my blog as well. So, yeah. And I freelance write, too.
Like, is that the answer you give people at parties?
So someone brought this up last week in New York and said, so you're going with writer first now, then photographer? And I said, it's been a conscious switch because I want to get better at writing. So I'm selling that more now.
Yeah, that's actually how I describe it, too. It depends on the audience that I'm talking to, but really I start with writer now. And I think I started with food stylist before. And if I have to elaborate on more of what I do, I go into the other like aspects of my career path. But for the most part now, I'm focused on writing, and that's how I kind of self-identify. So I'm just putting that out into the world.
And also, if you guys want to say your name and introduce any projects you're working on, because I realize we also did not do that. Sorry.
Do you want to go first? Okay. I'm Rebecca Pepler, and I have a book coming out in October also called Aperitif Cocktail or the French Way. Yeah.
So I'm Nick Sharma, she already said that. I have a book coming out on October 2nd, and it's called Season.
Hello, I'm Eva Cosmas Flores, and I have a cookbook coming out on March 20th called First We Eat. And it's just all about seasonal cooking, a little bit of Pacific Northwest food thrown in. When I'm at a party and someone asks me what I do, I usually just say photographer because that's like a pretty easy thing that I don't have to explain too much. But what I really do is I'm a food photographer, stylist. I have a blog called Adventures in Cooking. I've written another cookbook before as well. And I also teach photography and do workshops. Some of them are travel-based. And then I also teach them online on firstweeat.co as well. So a lot of different things. So that's why photographers like the easy thing to say.
I'm Maria Ziska, and I'm a cookbook writer. That's what I say at a party.
And that's true. That's true. That's primarily what you do, right?
Yep. Yeah, that's what I do.
So I'm curious also to hear from you guys, two questions really. What did you set out to do before you became these multi-pronged professionals? And do you think it's possible nowadays to still be a specialist? Because I know I set out to be a food writer. It took me like probably 7 years to do that. But now I'm so happy that I have all these other skills. I produced radio for 5 years. I've produced TV now. I've done all these other things that make my world more enriched. But I just wonder if it's possible to set out to be a food writer and just become that nowadays. Whoever wants to jump in.
I guess. I don't know. I feel like I'm still learning how to be a writer, which is, I think with everything, whatever you want to do, you should be passionate about it. I came from a world, I was a geneticist before this.
Whoa.
And then...
That is not what I was expecting.
I quit and went into food, worked as a cook for a while just to understand what was going on. But I think whatever you do, you should be passionate about it. And it shows in your photographs, in your writing. And I think just practice. At least that was my case. I just practiced with everything. And I still practice because I think you always need to sharpen your skills a little bit.
Mm-hmm. I had a really winding path to getting to be a writer. I studied journalism at university and then moved to New York to go to pastry school, mainly because I wanted to write about food. I wanted to be a cookbook author and had absolutely no idea how to do it. I grew up in Wisconsin. There wasn't a whole lot of like forward momentum there in the publishing field. So then I kind of like fell into TV. I fell into food styling and I kind of like just like hopscotched my way through all of these different skill sets and careers until finally I was able to cobble them all together and start doing what I kind of set off wanting to do in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And Eva, you studied film, right?
Yes, I did. I went to LMU here in LA. I got my bachelor's degree in film production. I wanted to be a documentary filmmaker. And when I graduated film school, it was in 2009, and it was when the economy really bottomed out, and so I was unemployed for 6 months. And I was like, well, I have all this time, and I love cooking, because my parents had a Greek deli for 30 years in Portland, Oregon. So I started a blog and had no intention of making a career or job out of that. At that time, that wasn't really a career option anyway. It was like in the early days of food blogging. So I definitely really fell into it. But that being said, I think that you can totally start a blog now or start wanting to be a food stylist from the beginning and make it happen. Mm-hmm. I think there's so many resources out there for people who already have a clear idea of the path that they want to go on, and there's lots of ways to pursue that. So, yeah.
Well, I have loved cookbooks since I was a little girl. My parents joke that they would, you know, I'd go over to a friend's house to play and they'd come pick me up and I'd be sprawled out on the kitchen with stacks of cookbooks around me. I was fascinated with recipes from a really young age, but I didn't quite know then that that was a career that you could have. You know, that seemed like way too good to be true. So I, in college, studied biology and then went to graduate school and started writing cookbooks pretty much right away.
What did you study in graduate school?
I went to an incredible university in northern Italy. Some of you probably know it's called UNISG, the University of Gastronomic Sciences. And I did their master's program in food culture and communications.
Okay, so this leads to my next question, which is how much of this is something that you can learn in like a school environment, for instance, like you did, Maria? And how much of this is just hustle? Like, as you said, Eva, there's so many resources for people out there. If you want to become a food stylist, there's so much information about how to take great, or how to style, or how to take great photos now. So what advice do you have for people out there? Should they take the time to go to culinary school? Should they just start cooking? Should they just start writing? What's the path?
Analytically, because that's how I think. So cooking, if you're going to write a blog and you have to photograph a video and, like you'd say, right, video and photos are the biggest component of food in a blog. If you are really conscious about styling, figure out your audience and the kind of food that you're going to style. If it's more restaurant-centric, I would recommend going in a restaurant or going to culinary school, learning those skills or the tools that they use. If it's more home style, then you can kind of play with it a little bit. Look at cookbooks. Those are really good inspirational places, or stylists like the two of them. Are really good resources. Writing, that was a challenge for me because I'm very used to writing like a scientist, but not as a food author. And so I decided to surround myself with books that were published a really long time ago. So I read M.F.K. Fisher and all the other famous authors of those times. And then also authors that, say, wrote the 1950 Sunset Cookbook, for example. Because I was really keen on understanding California cuisine and how it transformed. That was my passion. And I went back and looked into those resources, spoke to authors that had maybe researched and what I could identify and learn from.
And I love how methodical this is. This is amazing.
I overanalyze everything.
More haphazard. I don't know.
I have like the exact opposite experience and advice to give. I didn't overanalyze anything. I think I underanalyzed everything and just kind of threw myself into the fire or got thrown into the fire and just tried my best not to drown or whatever the correct analogy is with that one. I think the main thing for me was learning from other people and immersing myself both within like a culture of books, if you're a writer or a stylist, like looking at what people are doing and what the kind of the trajectory of the the aesthetic has been, because styling especially has shifted so much and is shifting again. And I think kind of staying on the cutting edge and like seeing what you personally want to do and how it kind of lines up with what's happening mainstream, but also looking ahead to see what we can do differently. Because this whole like rustic, chic, crumpled linen napkin thing is like ending.
Where are we going?
And there's a lot of different places. I think a lot of people are thinking we're going clean and super, you know, minimalist. I personally am loving the pops of color that are happening and kind of playing off of what's natural and what's a little bit unnatural. But to kind of circle back to the original point, I think my career has been built off of the generosity of people that have come before me who have been able to be willing enough to kind of lift me up when I was still learning, when I was definitely messing things up, when I was probably messing their things up that then they had to like redo. There is a culture, I think, in all the industries that any of us are a part of where people are less willing to take on young blood and a little competitive with where the work is going to come from. I think there's always going to be enough work for all of us and lifting each other up and finding people that are kind of willing to give you that experience and kind of take you along for the ride is so important. That's the way that my career has blossomed, and I think that that's kind of the way the industry is heading.
I think it also has to do a lot with how you learn best. So I really like the structured classroom environment. So I took my first photography class when I was 15, and I took photography classes again when I was at university, and that was really useful for me. But on the flip side, as a creative person, learning something hands-on is also very intuitive and incredibly effective. So I would say, as far as learning stuff, just ask yourself, how do I learn best? Do I feel like I need to be in a classroom, or am I more trial by fire? Do I want to just dive in, get my hands dirty, learn from my mistakes? They're both really effective, but I think you just have to figure out like what works best for you. And kind of going off of like the whole trend thing, I also feel like people can be really hard on themselves, especially in this world where you do have to wear a bunch of hats and you have to be very active on Instagram, and then you have to be writing, and you also have to be a stylist, and you also have to be a photographer. And even though there's trends that are always going on, don't let that weigh you down and feel like this has to be the path that I have to follow if I want to be successful. I have to like have this linen thing, and I have to shoot on a white background. I have to do it this way. Just do what feels right for you. When you're doing the work, are you happy that you're doing it, or are you hating yourself when you're doing it? So just finding the path that makes you happy and gives you that really satisfied feeling of just kind of being in tune, I guess, with your passion. So find out what makes you happy and kind of follow that rather than letting the trends of the time dictate the work that you're doing.
Yeah, I would agree. I think education is super valuable, and I'm really grateful for the education I've had. But I think it's also personal, and you have to do what works for you. And so I can only really speak to if you want to be a cookbook writer, the number one advice I would say is to cook at home as much as possible. And it sounds so obvious, right? Like that's what cookbooks are for, cooking at home. But I think it's critical to have a strong understanding of what it actually is like to cook at home and how that's different than cooking in a restaurant, and to be able to write with experience from that place.
One thing I think is so admirable about all of you is that you have both done a lot of work for other people, and you've also created a lot of your own content. So whether, you know, you write for a newspaper, you styled in magazines, TV shows, you've written other cookbooks. Maria, you're now writing your own cookbook. So at this point, when traditional media is sort of disappearing and creating your own brand, I'd love to hear what you guys think of the word brand, by the way, is so important. Like, how do you juggle the gigs with the traditional media and creating your own content? And which one is more important to you at this point? Anyone can jump in. We don't have to go in order.
For me right now, like creating my own content is more important, just because I feel like the more self-reliant you can be, the better. So if you can do stuff just like from a business perspective that's more passive income based and that you can control it, that's going to be safer than waiting on a client offer to come in. So yeah, I've been moving more towards the educational aspect because I love teaching. My mom's a teacher, my sister's a teacher. So for me, teaching photography is something that I really enjoy doing. And it also gives me a lot more freedom and flexibility because I'm not like, oh my gosh, I hope like I get an offer for the next contract to come in and like sweating it out, I can kind of make my own income that way. And I really enjoy the freedom in doing that. So that's what I've been doing.
Yeah, I think it's been really interesting for me because as a stylist and co-writing or co-authoring, I'm sure Maria can speak to this quite a bit too. You're writing or you're styling in other people's voices and their vision, and you're kind of trying to chat with them to make sure that you're putting their perfect vision forward. And so finally getting to do something that feels very much me has been really self-fulfilling and kind of almost emotionally healing for me because it's finally like tapping into what my voice actually is. Like it's shifted when I started writing the book, or at least the proposal for the book that I have coming out. The proposal reads, when I go back and read it now, I'm like, who is this person? Like, oh my God, I was really like reaching for something and playing with a bunch of different voices and reading a bunch of really interesting writers that are happening right now in the food industry has kind of helped me hone what feels right rather than like what you were saying, what, you know, the industry is doing right now, like actually figuring out what's right for me. And I think that's been the most important part. That said, a monetary piece of the puzzle, which I think you were just starting to get into.
Yeah, I want to hear about this.
Is that it's very difficult. People are doing it. I mean, I have, you know, some of my closest mentors are doing it, and they're doing it very well by just branding themselves. Like Dory Greenspan and Melissa Clark are all doing this on their own brand kind of platform. It's still very difficult to do. I definitely still need the income that I get from styling jobs that, you know, like I'll talk about some of the stuff that I do, like for cookbooks and more passionate projects, but I also do ad jobs that I don't really talk about because I'm not, they're not quite in line with what my vision and my voice is now, but I also have rent to pay and I like to travel and eat. And so like, those are things that are actual, you know, things you have to think about every day without, you know, just focusing on your voice and your craft and the passion that you have behind things.
Before we started talking, Rebecca and I were up here saying that like the things that people think we do are the things that no one pays us money for. So it seems so glamorous, but like really, you know, we're taking, yeah, ad jobs, branded content, stuff like that, that you don't have your byline on necessarily.
Yeah, Instagram life looks a little bit more curated.
Sure.
If you're still trying to build your brand platform, but also have money in your bank account.
I think I have the same approach. I think for me, it was more identifying what my point of view was over the past couple of years. And then I started out experimenting with a bunch of different projects, kind of, you know, learning what I really wanted to do with my life and this career, because I had in the ocean, I couldn't swim. So I kind of played with a bunch of different things, kind of, you know, this wasn't working for me, that was working better for me. And so I picked what I was best at and went with that. And that's what I would recommend to everyone who decides to jump into this and hustle. I've actually stopped doing a lot of freelance jobs where my name is not on, it's not shown up, because I've moved into this phase now of my career where I really want my name to be known for writing as well as for the food I create and photographing. And so I've stopped doing a lot of sponsored work also over the past couple of months, maybe a year now.
Yeah, I've always worked with people and for myself from the beginning, and I adore collaborating with chefs on books, and I also adore doing my own books, and I think they really play off of each other and work to make the other one better. So I am often asked if I will switch into just doing my own books in the future, but the truth is that I hope to always continue collaborating and having both.
How important are books for you guys, to have your name on a book? What does that do for you in all aspects of your career? Is it just one part, or is it like the thing that you can give almost as a business card?
I think it definitely gives a sense of legitimacy, and like it helps kind of, not to use the word brand, but it helps brand you as like an expert in your field. Like you have clearly spent a lot of time working on this, so you know something about it. So I think personally, it speaks more to like your skill in the cookbook realm as like a recipe developer, a photographer if you've shot it yourself, and also just being able to maintain a schedule, because I mean, we all know there's so much work that goes into writing a cookbook, and if you're not organized, you can make a real mess of things. So I think it also speaks to your ability to just be an organized, functioning human being as well.
Wow. Yeah. Turning into Lindsay over here. Yeah, I personally, like on a personal level, having my name on a book is very special. My mom's a librarian. Books have always been a huge part of my life. Like having the tactile experience of holding a book. I've worked in digital media for so long that it's really nice to still to know that the world still wants books and wants printed page. Career-wise, I agree. I think that there's a prestige to it and kind of an acknowledgement of your kind of status within the industry when you've, you know, finally been able to go through the, like, we haven't even talked about, like, writing the book takes forever and, like, shooting it and et cetera, but, like, writing a proposal, getting a publisher, you know, shopping it around depending on how you did it, like, that's a year before you've even started writing the book, and then it takes another year to write and another year to kind of publish, and there's, like, this whole kind of back story behind any book that's been written that is, you know, at least in traditional publishing as it is now, takes a long time to get to. So it's also a history of, and I think we've all been kind of working towards this place in our life where we can now say, oh yeah, I wrote a book. But like we can say that for the last 3 years. We just haven't been able to say it out loud to people and like have anything to show for it. Now at least we can be like, oh, there's an Instagram or there's a link on Amazon to pre-order. You can order it and go to your local bookstore. So I think that's, yeah, for me, very, very special personally and professionally.
Yeah, I feel it, like Eva said, it adds legitimacy to your professional, whatever skills you've been cultivating over the past couple of years. It's nice, you know, like, I still don't have the physical copy of my book, my designer sitting somewhere over there. But when my designer sent the galleys to me, that was very gratifying. You get to see the galleys, you get to see these photos you've taken. This is what you've been working over for the past maybe 2 years. So it's exciting, and then you actually get a day where you can go out in the world, take that book and say, hey, I actually wrote that. But I've been to meetings. I used to work at a startup in San Francisco where we would look at stylists and photographers. A lot of them would come in with their cookbooks and or magazine covers that maybe they had shot, and that's what we would actually look for when hiring people. So it does make a difference outside.
Maria, do you have anything to add?
No. I agree. Agree with all of it. Books are even better than business cards.
All right. Well, Maria, you have to answer this next question first. So something that Eva said that I definitely want to talk about is just organization. Like as much as I hated a 9-to-5 job, I like sort of fantasize about just clocking in and clocking out. The reality is that you're working all the time. Like there's no distinction between a Sunday and a Monday in this world. How do you guys do it? How do you stay organized? Do you keep a structure? Do you just whack-a-mole? What do you do?
This is such a good question. I don't know that I'm the best person to answer this because, like you, I'm fascinated with corporate culture. I've never had a desk job, so I am always asking my friends, like, so what do you do on a lunch break? And, like, what's on your desk? And how does it work if it's a sick day? Like, I have no idea.
What's a standing desk?
Yeah. But I can only speak to my own experience. And I have tried to build in as much structure as possible into my work. So I'm really deliberate about starting at the same time every day and finishing. And yes, I work on weekends and there's certain holidays that I've never celebrated. Like we just had one where all my friends were off work and I'm like, it's a Monday. What is this? I think that if you put in a lot of structure, then you have the freedom in between to be creative and to be more loose with the ideas and, you know, especially with writing. I think that's important.
Do you ever wear your pajamas all day long?
Yes, definitely.
Because I do. How do you guys structure?
I do not structure very well. I've learned that I work best in the morning. And I think that that's my most structured part is that I know the times of the day that I work best and kind of what I need to do. And, you know, I make a tea and I sit down and I have a specific place that I sit in whatever house that I'm at the time. I've been traveling a lot, so it's a little different wherever I am. But I think that working as freelance, you know, time zones don't matter. I don't live in New York, the West Coast is like on a kind of follows New York time. I actually live in Paris, so like I'm on a whole different time structure. So when I wake up, I'm checking emails from like I don't even know what time it is sometimes, depending on where my editor is at. But I think just fitting in work whenever I feel productive is the best way for me. Like, if I'm like, I've got a couple hours and I don't feel like just laying around in my pajamas and watching Netflix, then, like, I'm working. But when deadlines come, they're, like, super helpful. That's, like, when I'm like, oh, I have 12 hours to work straight through, and I'm not going to get all of this done. But then I'm, like, very focused. So I think that setting internal deadlines is super important to me when I have something that's not necessarily for a client, but it's something that I actually want to get done personally. But when I have a client-based deadline, it's a lot easier to motivate and focus. Yeah.
I'm not the most structured person. I'm a very analytical person, but structure-wise, I'm just not. I've tried a bunch of things like Asana and just to coordinate things, and I never follow up. But deadlines really help. Like, if someone tells me, hey, I need this story by Monday, I got to make sure it's there on Monday in the mail. So deadlines, I think, put the fear of God in me, and then I just get stuff done.
I would agree with that. Self-imposed deadlines are super important. I really like structure. So as soon as I signed my cookbook deal, I'm also really into Google Calendar. So I Google Calendared all the recipe development days and like when I need to go grocery shopping. And I also have a terrible memory. So I feel like if it's not in my calendar, I'm paralyzed by the fear that I'm going to forget something very important. So as soon as I signed it, I just like scheduled out the whole thing. And that made it a lot easier.
Impressive. Okay, I have one last question because I assume that some people in here might be interested in doing this kind of work. I'm sure all of you have been taken out to coffee by some college graduate who's like, I want to do what you do. What's your advice? What do you tell them?
Yeah. If you couldn't hear, he was saying, don't do it.
Run.
No, I've been the person that's taken people out for coffee and also been taken out for coffee. And I think that the biggest kind of advice that I've ever been given is to talk to people and learn from people and not make yourself into this one like woman or one man show. Like actually getting out into the world and learning and experiencing and asking for help. And finding the people that are willing to foster and help you. And also, take the fantasy out of it a little bit. I think that there's definitely this, like, fantasy realm of, like, we do just sit around in our pajamas all day, and then we get some work done, and then we're writers, and it's amazing, and we also pay our bills and go on luxurious vacations. But there's a ton of work that goes in those, like, in-between moments when you're not seeing it on, like, Instagram or social media or talking about it or, like, you know, as we were saying, like, the ramp up to actually publishing a book is not a 10-month process. It's a 3-year process. And we're not talking about it all the time. So it's a wonderful career, and we're so lucky to do it. And the fantasy definitely is sometimes the reality, but it's not overarching. I think that's my biggest advice is don't get caught up in the fantasy. Like, live in the reality and enjoy the moments that are actually fantastic because they really are.
I would also add to that, just don't expect for everything to work out right away. I feel like our culture right now especially is all about instant gratification. And the reality is you're going to work really hard probably for a few years and you won't feel like you're seeing the fruit of your labor. But if you stick with it, that's when you push through because a lot of times other people give up and that's when you're still standing. So just be prepared for some tough times. But know that if you persevere and you just work really hard, it'll be worth it.
I think one thing with freelancing and import, you know, a lot of your work you create, you're really proud of it and you want it to be accepted by editors. It's okay to get rejected. That's something that we really don't talk about. And I feel, at least with me, you should learn how to take rejection and also learn from that. Figure out what they're trying to tell you and improve on those mistakes. At least that's what I think helped me the most. So I think that's a big part of growing up.
I think if you want to work in this community, it's a spectacular group of people. I think that people who work in food are inherently generous people, and it's wonderful to be part of that. And I have a story that when I was in college, I wasn't quite sure how I was going to make this into a career. And I went to a bakery in town, a little bakery, and was talking to the owner. And he, you know, I didn't know what I was looking for, but I just hoped for a little guidance or encouragement. And he said, don't do it. Give up now. Stop what you're doing and, you know, do something else. And it was so hard to hear because I was really excited and I'm somehow found the courage to keep working, and I'm really glad I did. And the lesson that I learned was not everybody's gonna be thrilled if you have this dream and you're gonna pursue it, but if it's something you're passionate about and it makes you a little bit scared in a good way, go for it. Go for it and find the people who are gonna support you.
Wonderful advice. Does anyone have any questions?
You've all done a lot of freelance work across several different markets, and I see the digital landscape changing faster than I can certainly keep up with it. I'm wondering how you're feeling about sponsored content. Is there a sea change coming? Do you feel it?
I feel like it's going to be the new main way that people are advertised to. That's just what I feel like is probably going to happen, because I know when I'm driving down the road, I don't really pay attention to billboards. When there's like sidebar ads online, I've like learned to kind of zone those out. So I feel like if I'm following somebody and I'm genuinely interested in their lives and what they're doing, if they're endorsing a product, that's when I'm going to notice it. So that's kind of my ticket. That's where I see kind of the ad world going.
It is changing fast. I've noticed like a lot of online sites like Mashable and a couple of other places actually weaving ads into their stories now. And I think what will happen is brands will probably go to larger sites like those and not to individual sponsors. So I see also a shift in the next couple of years from like influencers. I think that will probably decrease and it'll move back to media sites.
I don't know if I'm allowed to comment, but I think especially in a city like LA, where traditional media has pretty much been wiped out, you know, the LA Weekly, LAist, Los Angeles Times has only 4 staffers in the food section who all are super overworked. That's where the money is. And so young writers, especially if they aren't as established and don't have the opportunities that these guys do, that's where they're kind of cutting their teeth, and that's where they end up because they're just trying to pay their bills. So I'm not sure where that's all going to go, but I know that I know food writers here in Los Angeles who have ended up moving into branded content because they feel like that is the only way they can.
Another question in the crowd.
Hi. Something, Eva, that you spoke on, and it's just something that I'm personally curious about, is you talked about making your own job, while at the same time, we are still struggling with gaining our confidence in our field. So I'm just wondering, how do you reconcile finding value in yourself and your product and putting it out there and getting paid for it?
Yeah. So a little backstory. I worked a full-time job as an NBC page. Then I was a coordinator at NBC Universal. Then I worked on a sitcom as a line producer's assistant while having my blog, before I signed my very first cookbook deal. And so that's when I made the jump to blogging and Instagramming full time. So I know the struggle of not having confidence in yourself and also your ability just to pay your bills. Like for me, that was the hardest part, was will I be able to make enough money to pay my rent? And it is really, really difficult. But I think the most important thing that you need to look at is quality of life. So when I was working full-time at my day job, all I looked forward to was the weekend when I'd be working on my blog and shooting and styling. And then when the opportunity came along to make the jump, that's when I felt safe enough to take it. As far as reconciling the two, I think you need to look at what, and I know it sounds gimmicky, but like, what are you most passionate about? What makes you happy? And then I think you need to find a way to work it into your life somehow. If you're not able to do it full time, that's very realistic, and that's probably what it's like for most people. But I think it's really important to keep it a part of your life. So even if it's just like one day a week, where you're blogging or shooting or just cooking in your kitchen, that's really important. And practicing is going to give you the most confidence. Like, the more you practice, the better you're going to get. And you'll feel it, too. You'll see your work, and you'll be like, oh, my gosh, like, I feel like that actually looks pretty good. Whereas, you know, when you're struggling, it's hard. So just persevere and practice. And that's really going to boost your confidence, too, because you're going to start to get bigger deals because more people will notice your work and the quality of your work is going up. I would just say keep practicing. And it will boost your confidence.
Just really to ping off of that, I think the one thing that I've noticed is that no one is going to be your biggest advocate except for you. If you're working for yourself, you're your boss, you're the person that's getting out there, you're your publicist most of the time. And cultivating a sense of self-confidence, both within your work or just within, you know, a general kind of landscape, is really important in getting other people to be confident in you. So I know that that's kind of like a backdoor answer, but kind of like, you know, feeling your own self-worth and projecting it out into the world, even if you're not 100% behind it personally. I have no idea what you're saying. Oh, yes. Act like a white man would. That is a great way to describe it. And that it does, like, bring up the idea of, like, at least as a woman asking for what you're worth, literally, monetary-wise. Like, I just had to ask for a budget for a big job that I'm on, and I was texting with a friend, and I was like, I don't know, is this, like, too much? Is it too little? Am I doing too much? And she was like, just, like, ask for what you think is right, and they'll tell you if it's too much. And lo and behold, I like sent the, you know, quote in, and the white gentleman that I was working with wrote me back and was like, that's great. I was like, son of a, I should have. Next time, add another grand on top of that. So you're still always learning, but like just like projecting that and starting to, you know, think of yourself as worth what you're actually worth, people will respect it if you're, you know, putting it out into the world.
Any other question? We can take one more.
This one is from the back. Sorry, can't see you from back here. Most of you are doing the writing, the shooting, and the styling. Was that, or is that in by necessity, or is that sustainable over the long term? Do you want to slough off part of that as your career grows, or will you always have to do everything from start to finish?
I'll speak to my experience first. I am not a photographer, although I get mistaken for one constantly. Like, I get asked to do photo jobs, and I'm like, hi, I'm a food stylist, which is a very different thing, and I can write some copy for you. But yes, I think focusing has helped me greatly. Kind of like starting out in my career, I needed to do everything and learn how to do everything and get a big skill set in order to be hired for jobs because I didn't have one thing that I was very good at. And as I kind of have grown in my career, I've been able to kind of narrow my focus and define what I'm interested in doing and focus on growing that aspect of myself while still maintaining these other jobs for cash flow or whatever, just to get out into the world instead of sitting at a desk writing all the time. I think that it's important to define at least personally what you want, even if you're still doing a bunch of other things.
I was going to say that recipe writing and recipe testing are often done by two different people, that those are usually separate jobs. But to me, they're inseparable. I always work on both simultaneously, and I think it makes for better work to be able to do that. I would encourage anyone who's interested in recipes to give that a try.
I think, at least for my work that I do, where my name is actually on stuff, I make sure that I'm completely involved in the entire process, which is a little crazy, but it's just because my point of view is very structured and very strong visually and with my words, so I've kind of kept it like that. But maybe down the line, maybe I'd give up a little bit of styling because I feel that will give me a little bit of... open my mind up to the photography then, because that's such a different concept from just styling food. And I know a lot of people think of them as one unit. That's what she was kind of alluding to. But mentally, you do need a little bit of free space to be different every time, to rethink, be creative.
I think for my own cookbooks, I really enjoy being able to do the recipe testing and the styling and the photography and the writing myself because it's like a true representation of my voice. But I also have, I shot the Wicked Healthy cookbook. That's also coming out next month. It's an awesome vegan cookbook you guys should all check out. But for that shoot, I had a food stylist and a prop stylist, and I didn't write the book. I was just a photographer, and I loved it. It was really great. I got to just focus in on my craft and work with other people who are insanely talented at what they do. And it was like a real collaboration. So I think it just it depends on the project.
Now for a really fantastic conversation with some of LA's top Asian American chefs and restaurateurs. They're exploring the meaning of what's been called the rise of, quote, Asian American cuisine.
Good afternoon. Thank you to everyone out here. Thank you to the Food Book Fair. Real quick, so I'm Oliver Wang. I'm a sociology professor down at Cal State Long Beach, and I write about arts and culture, and I really could not be more thrilled than moderate today's panel with our illustrious guests here. As noted, we don't have a ton of time, so if we can just get things started by having each panelist, I want you to introduce yourselves, and by way of doing that, can you tell us about how and when each of you decided that you wanted to make a career out of food, and however that happened, whatever that pathway was?
Hi, good afternoon, everyone. I'm Charles Solalia. I'm the chef and owner of Rice Bar here in downtown.
How did that happen?
Organically, I guess. It was right after college. I just wanted to learn a skill before med school, and I never went back. You know, it was an excuse to travel and make a living out of while traveling, but it became the path.
Was there a gateway moment in which you realized, oh, this is what I want to do?
When I left the Philippines, when I was like, I'm never coming back, I had to make it happen. There was no choice.
My name's Natasha Fan, and do you guys know the Kogi truck or been to the Line Hotel?
I think some folks in the audience might be familiar with Kogi, yeah.
Yeah, well, I don't know. So yeah, I do business development, marketing, communications for Kogi. I've been Roy Choi's business and creative partner for 9 years now and different restaurants all over LA. And
you helped write LA Sun.
Yes, I co-authored, well, yeah.
Yeah, available.
I mean, it's Roy's life and his, he wrote it and we were there to help him bring out the best. And I grew up in Echo Park. I was born into a food family and a food business. Anyone here live or been to Echo Park, familiar with Echo Park? My parents opened an Asian and Latino grocery store on Sunset Boulevard called A Grocery Warehouse in the early 80s. And that was, you know, my life for, you know, I was surrounded by food, by produce, by fishmongers, all of that. And graduated from college, went into advertising for Taco Bell, worked at Martha Stewart, and found food again when I met Roy at a panel discussion. And then that was, you know, that was it. I just, you know, hit the ground running with Kogi. And since then, we've opened several restaurants and more to come. And yeah.
Hi, I'm Ken Concepcion. My wife, Michelle, and I, we own Now Serving. I think with food, it was, I mean, being an Asian in an Asian family, my parents are from the Philippines. Food was always around. And being a latchkey kid in the 80s, 70s and 80s, we were kind of like left to our own devices to feed ourselves. It wasn't really that bad, but it was just like, okay, there's rice in the fridge, there's chicken here, figure it out. And then I didn't start getting paid for food until after college, just like Charles, where I think we both were forced to go to college. And then after college, I just had the cooking bug and started working in kitchens on the line.
Hi, I'm Naoko Takemura. I'm from actually Japan, from Tokyo, and I'm the owner of the shop called Toiro, which opened about 4 months ago on La Brea Avenue.
Ooh, congratulations.
Thank you so much. So please come visit when you have a chance. Actually, tomorrow we have Spring Festival from 1 to 4. It's open to the public, so please come visit. And I'm also, my shop specializes in Japanese donabe, which is a Japanese earthenware clay pot. And all the pottery and other kitchenware, tableware, all artisan products from all over Japan, hand-selected by myself. Also, I'm the author of the book called Donabe. So that's the book of Japanese clay pot cooking. And I was born and grew up in Tokyo, and then I came to the United States, LA, in 2001. And I was actually back in Japan. I was in the music business, but I grew up eating really good food. My mom always cooked wonderful food, and my dad always took us to wonderful restaurants, very seasonal. I always loved cooking, and so after I moved to, and after my music business, I really wanted to learn professional cooking, and I came to the LA to go to the culinary school, and I studied cooking professionally. And after that, I started teaching clay pot cooking, and I opened my shop. Long story short.
It's funny because a lot of people say that the new rock stars are cooks and chefs. So you would be that you have demonstrated the transition from music into food in that respect. So I have a couple questions for anyone on the panel who wants to answer this. And one of the first ones is something that I've been thinking about a lot. And this is as someone who has researched and written about Asian Americans in pop culture for the last 25 years, is what's, to me, so striking about the current moment, especially in Los Angeles, in which you have so many prominent creative Asian Americans involved in some aspect of the food business, is that in other areas of pop culture, you think about music, you think about sports, you think about movies, Asian Americans are often still treated as aliens or as novelty items. But in the food industry, we get the pass because no one questions our presence. No one looks at an Asian American in a restaurant and thinks, this doesn't make sense to me. It's seen as very natural, very authentic, if I can use that word. And I'm wondering if that might help to some extent explain why, especially for younger Asian Americans, food has become such a passion, whether in a professional way as exemplified by people on the panel or simply people who spend way too much time on Yelp, for example. Is it partly because this is one lane within pop culture where we can actually excel without people stopping to question what we're even doing here to begin with? And I'll throw this to anyone on the panel.
I don't know. I've never kind of seen it like that. But it's almost like nobody questions us if we decide to cook a hot dog or a hamburger. You know, the cliche is, I think I just used it the other night. If the restaurant's full of Asians, then the food's got to be good, right? It is true, by the way. I think the NFL just got their first like Korean kicker, and that was like a big thing.
Right. Right. It's treated as unusual. It's treated as a novelty.
Right.
He kind of flamed out, but we don't have to talk about that.
Exactly. We won't bring it up. But I think that there's something intrinsically wired as Asians and Asian Americans with food. We have such a, I think we have a, like a, this kind of internal connection to it that is, I don't know if people just see that or, I don't know if I have an answer to that, but now that you've kind of shown that light, I think it's pretty interesting.
I mean, I think Asian food is, it's universal, you know, and so there's an openness about Asian food, an openness to expand it and expand the pantry and the flavors and all of that. And I think that translates into, you know, how we perceive it psychologically, you know, and we don't really think twice about it. It just sort of organically happens. So, I mean, I didn't think about that. That's a great point. Should write a paper on that.
Working on it. I'll be re-interviewing all of you later. But
all right, on my end, I think if you're in a, the good thing about being in California is like we're so diverse here. So you can always coax your restaurant into a California restaurant and you can cook whatever you want to cook. I used to lead a French kitchen, and as a Filipino running a French kitchen, there was always be a comments where this is not French food, you know, even though it's what you've learned in all your chefs, whatever. It was just tough because the reference point of people that's, say, the French eating that type of food, they can always say something for you about what you're cooking. But if you're cooking your Asian food or something that you really believe in, it's something that you've eaten your whole life, if somebody questions you, you have a much stronger, much dignified stance on what they say. So I don't think we really get a pass. I think it's more of where you position yourself and what you're cooking and where you believe is what's good, not just because it's popular, not just because it's what you learned. It's because it has the story and the reference point that can support it. That's where it's at.
I think it's first of all the time. Just the time has evolved and people became more exposed to different cultural food, cultural cuisines. And also I think it's the effort of a lot of people. For example, a lot of Asian descendant people are trying to make good food and also spread their culture. And so I think that's part of the reason.
I think also one point that has various people have made here is that there is a very long, 150-plus year tradition of Asians in America making food. And certainly I think both people on the panel, people in the audience may relate to this, is that for those of us who grew up with Asian immigrant elders, we knew a lot of people who ran restaurants, but primarily more out of economic survival than anything else. You know, I have an uncle, for example, who ran a Chinese restaurant in a tiny town in Maine for 25 years, but he had no ambitions of elevating Chinese cuisine or trying to put his own spin on it. It was just a way for him to provide for him and his family. And I've certainly spoken to Asian American entrepreneurs, second generation or later, whose parents at least initially were a little peeved at the idea that their kids would go into the food industry, because for them, it's like, I busted my ass in a kitchen, so you didn't have to work in a kitchen, so why are you working in a kitchen? And I'm wondering, can anyone on here, and Natasha in particular, because you come from a family in which your parents were in the food business or still are, whether or not there was any sort of skepticism or the desire for you maybe not to do that, or again, anyone else on the panel can answer this, but Natasha, why don't we start with you?
I didn't grow up in a restaurant, but I grew up in a grocery store, and my parents thought that after I graduated from UCLA, you know, I wouldn't apply to any job, that I would end up in the store, managing the store and taking it over. And they were so pissed that I chose to go work at an advertising agency to make ads for Taco Bell. They didn't understand it. It, like, the whole concept of it was just so, you know, out of this world for them. And then when I left and went to work after Martha's Vineyard, went to work for a taco truck, that was even more of, like, at the time it was 2009, early 2009, we were the first truck to really, you know, explode on the scene. And so they didn't understand, it's not what it is today. You know, and they're like, you are leaving a salary job to work for a taco truck? Like, what is this all about? And we actually brought the truck out to their store and we parked it. And there was a huge line that went up this stairwell. And there was like 300 people in line. And I told my parents to keep the store open late so people can go in. And
nice.
Yeah, right? Good move, right? And they'd never tried the food before. They'd never met Roy before. And the whole family came out. My dad's like, oh, I get it now. Like, that's what it's about, you know? Like, and so, you know, it was, and to this day, they always ask me, like, so what do you do? Like, I don't understand what you do. You know, you're not working in the kitchen. You're not, you know, working in front of house. So what do you do? And I try to explain. They don't understand. They always complain that my food is too expensive.
I get the same thing.
It's too expensive. And they're always telling me, like, you should add Vietnamese egg rolls to the menu. They're like, I have a really great recipe. I mean, I think there's definitely a disconnect, you know, between... They're just never going to really understand what I do. And they can, you know, and I'm okay with that separation. I'm okay with that gap because it gives me the space and the room to explore myself and to expand my career and to not always have to give them answers, you know. And so I don't know. I don't know if that's a direct answer.
That is a very much a direct answer. Yeah. Yeah. Any other thoughts here?
I can still remember... I think it was in 1999, I had a conversation with my mom on the phone, and I had just, a few years earlier, I had graduated with a painting and creative writing degree, and...
Asian parents love that.
They love that, yeah. You're not an engineer, you're not a doctor, you're not a lawyer. And then I had started cooking for a couple of years, and my mom's like, what's going to happen with this? And I said, well, in 10 years, I could probably be a sous chef. And I heard the phone drop. And she's like, well, you can still go to grad school, right? It's okay. And then it's funny, this past year, opening up a bookstore, of all things, my parents are like, don't you just want to be a chef for Wolfgang?
They're hard to please, you know. Yeah. Shout out to all of our Asian
yes,
parents. So.
Yes.
So I was... you know, I always loved cooking, but it was until I was maybe in mid-20s, it never occurred to me that I was going to involve myself in the food-related business. But, you know, first I decided to quit my career and then move to California. And when I told my parents about it, my mom cried. And, you know, they thought, like, I was going to find a husband and, you know, have a happy life in Japan. And so first they were like really kind of sad, but Eventually, they were completely supportive. Then I became a student of culinary school. So for 1 year, because I was on the student visa, so I can't work. I wasn't earning any money, so I was just living out of my saving. And so my parents are really, really worried. But then, you know, I started to kind of, you know, build myself after that. So everything kind of worked out.
You're going to take a pass on this one?
Okay. I think mine would be a reverse of Natasha's. I come from a family of doctors. Both my parents were doctors and were 7 kids. All of them are in the field except me, and I'm the middle child. So a lot of it was going against my grain, you know. I remember going to finishing high school. My mom's like, what do you want to do? Well, I think I want to go to business school. And she's like, if you're not sure what you want to do yet, go to biology. So I graduated in four years, took my biology, graduated, and I was just like, I don't know, Mom. I was like, I just want to learn something. But just going against the grain and kind of pushes you more, I think it kind of establishes your drive to never go back. That's kind of what's been pushing me this whole time. And it took a while for them to understand why I'm slaving away in the kitchen and missing all the holiday parties, birthdays, weddings. But it was a commitment that even a doctor would make if they're in school. Because I just saw my brothers and my sisters do the same thing. They'd miss everything because they have to study, have to do that. So I promised myself when I got into cooking school, when I made it to a career, I was like, if I spend a good 10 years of my life with the same dedication as a medical student would do for their, you know, for studying, I should be somewhere, you know? And true enough, you know, at 13 years into it, I have this little restaurant. So it just keeps pushing, you know? Because even for doctors, it's nonstop push. I just told myself I'll put the same drive and same mentality into a different business. And now they're happy, especially when we eat out.
I want to come back to something that Natasha, you had just mentioned on the side, which is, you know, the idea that your parents think you spend too much on your meals. And this is something that I know Good Girl Dinette's Deep Tran has written about, which is the cheap eats problem when it comes, I think, in particular to Asian cuisine in the U.S., not so much necessarily for Japanese cuisine. I think people are willing to spend a lot of money for really good sushi or izakaya, but Chinese, Thai, Vietnamese, Korean, there's this expectation that it's supposed to be really, really inexpensive. And there's a lot of reluctance by consumers, Asian or otherwise, to pay more than a certain price point. I know this is something that all of you probably can relate to on some level. What is it going to take to sort of break different kinds of Asian cuisine out of the cheap eats sector, if you will?
Flavor. I always feel that if you can provide superior flavor that they can't compare to anything else of that cuisine, then you create a different tier for yourself. So that's one, that's very important. I think service is really important on top of that, and just be honest with the business. If you say you're going to use organic ingredients, keep using organic ingredients just to make margins, you know? But I think flavor. Because I do the same thing. If I go to a Chinese restaurant and I go to an expensive, like a Michelin-starred Chinese restaurant, it's the same. It's really the same. But it's really just the flavor. I mean, it's really just the service that's different. But it's really just creating that flavor, the very particular flavor profile that people would spend for.
I think what sort of screws it up for Asian food is, or the perception of it to be cheap and inexpensive, is there are restaurants out there that are sourcing produce and meats and everything from the same, you know, spots that fast food to-go restaurants are, you know, but they're charging $5 more for a plate of chow fun or, you know, $10 more for a bowl of noodles. And that's what sort of screws it up, you know, so there needs to be this balance. And I agree with you, quality, flavor, service, all the things that we, you know, don't give much thought to sometimes, that extra dollar or two, you know, it comes from that. And I don't know, for me personally, like, I'm giving up on convincing my parents that it's worth going to Slanted Door, you know, like, you know, Charles Fan's food is amazing. I love it. You know, there's a certain level of refinement and elegance to it that transports me as someone who's a child of Vietnamese immigrants. But my parents will never understand it. So personally, I'm definitely giving up on trying to convince them.
Yeah, I think, so not every entree comes with rice, that's what you're saying. This triggers another memory. You know, after I had started cooking, I had visited my parents in New York, and I was so excited to take them to
this new Filipino restaurant in Soho. It was called Cendrillon, Romy Dorotan and Amy Besta's place. And nothing was like it. And it was in fucking Soho. And I thought it was amazing and it was delicious. And my parents, they walked out of there and they hated it because they paid $60 for a brunch for four people. And they just said, this isn't real Filipino food. I think it's almost the scrappiness of Asian culture of putting together restaurants that will appeal to people on an everyday basis. Now it's almost, maybe it's almost like a curse now. But to me, seeing somebody like Charles and Natasha and, you know, the guys at Lhasa and, you know, I mean, Charles Phan is one of the best chefs in America. And you shouldn't see it as Vietnamese food. You shouldn't see what, like, Tetsu Yahagi is doing at Spago as Japanese food. It's three-star Michelin food. And you should pay a lot of money for it. And, you know, it's a thing, too. I can't argue with my parents anymore. And that's fine. I'm getting worked up about it. But.
I did not mean to turn this into a group therapy session about our parents. I really apologize
Are you going to send me an invoice after this?
I agree with all of you. And, you know, the taste and all the other things. And also, I think the training, the chefs, is also important. And also, you know, if you go to Tokyo, actually, like, along with French and Italian cuisines, Chinese is considered to be very high-end cuisine. And so if you ask someone, you know, on a date and take to the Chinese restaurant, that means, you know, you qualify. So, so it's because in Japan, there are a lot of really highly trained Chinese chefs, you know, sent to Japan to cook in Chinese restaurants. So I think that training is really important. And also, yeah, like Ken was saying that, you know, it doesn't have to be like super traditional or anything. You know, it's your original. So if you have your authenticity, I think that if you open up the door to more people.
One of the things that, especially in pulling together this particular panel, I've been dying to ask, is around the idea if there exists an specifically an Asian-American culinary sensibility. So I don't mean a Chinese-American, I don't mean a Thai-American, I mean an Asian-American culinary sensibility. I think of this place that unfortunately recently closed in Alhambra called Dips Grill that was around for about 5-6 years. And when I first started going there, they would have some more traditional, what you would call traditional Vietnamese cuisine like bun bo quay or spring rolls, but also, you know, pulled pork sliders and sweet potato fries. And I was thinking, who is this menu for? And then I realized it's for people like me who grew up in the SGV, and we want a little bit of taste of what we grew up with our parents, but then we kind of want the burgers that we always desired as kids that we never got to have on as an option as well. And to me, Dips, even though I'm sure they never necessarily put themselves out there as an Asian-American restaurant, captured something that I could relate to as a second-gen Asian-American. So for anyone on the panel, do you think there is an Asian-American food culture? Well, there's a culture, but is there an Asian-American food sensibility, and what does it look like, or better said, what does it taste like?
It tastes like a potluck, you know, dinner or meal. That's like, I grew up with that. I grew up with I went to school in Los Feliz at a private school, and Koreans, Filipinos, Central Americans, you know, everything. And we'd have multicultural day, and everyone was forced to bring a dish from their background. And that spread is what, you know, Thanksgiving dinner looks like and Christmas looks like and every day. And so our palates are so, you know, been trained and seasoned and nurtured, you know, for decades now to expect a certain flavor profile when we bite into a burger or even when we eat a plate of pasta, you know. Like, there's certain expectations. Umami is not, you know, something we strive for. It's expected. You know, it's something that is how we rate our food, and I'm sure Yelpers are, you know, judging based on that. So yeah, I think that informs, you know, how we create right menus, how we conceptualize, you know, restaurants, and even how we, you know, stock our stores with goods. You know, it comes from a very broad global perspective.
If I can append a question, this is for everyone who wants to tackle the overall question. Is there any place in LA that you have had food and thought, this is like an Asian American item, dish, restaurant?
I need time to think about that.
No, all good.
I mean, whenever Michelle and I go out for Chinese, I have no idea why she wants to order walnut shrimp, but I order egg foo young, and like I look for like the fat egg rolls, man. I mean, I think
that's so East Coast.
Yeah, for sure. I'm still looking for that. Anybody know where that fatty egg roll is? Let me know.
It's called Flushing.
Yeah, but I think like it's exciting what you're talking about, because Asian American food is where, like, there's recipes and cookbooks and chefs that are using like soy sauce and dashi in their bolognese, you know. And like when I cook beans at home in the crock pot, I throw a piece of kombu in there. It's so interesting to see where all these threads run through every dish and through every meal. And I mean, in St. Louis, you would have loved this. There's this crazy sandwich called the St. Paul sandwich. And it's two pieces of white bread, lettuce, tomato, onion, mayo, and egg foo young and gravy in there.
I'm actually in the midst of writing an article about the chow mein sandwich of Southeastern Massachusetts. So I've read about the St. Louis sandwich for the same reason.
Yeah. I actually asked Jonathan Gold once if he'd heard of it. And he's like, oh, no. I was like, yes.
You know, because I'm not from here, so I don't know if I can answer good question, give you a good answer. But I think, the combination of Western and Asian, that kind of represents that from both sides. You know, like your sandwich reminds me of the Japanese katsando, you know, like the cutlet originally came from Europe, but became part of like a Japanese European style cuisine, and then we made a sandwich out of it, and then, you know, with the Japanese version of Worcestershire sauce, and so it's just all the mixture. But you know, that's considered to be, you know, kind of Japanese and, you know, also kind of Western too.
Charles, you're gonna take a pen.
I'll skip this one.
Okay. I will say this, and I'm not saying this just to sort of butter up the people on the panel, but to me, one of the first times, besides Dips Grill, in terms of experiencing a dish that I thought captured that, was the first time I had the pork belly bowl at Chego. I'm like, oh my God, this is like my childhood wrapped up in a dish. And I kind of think that's kind of what Roy was going for.
Yeah, you're right. It was, you know, he describes Chego food as like everything in his refrigerator growing up, right? And thrown into this very composed dish. And we're very big on creating one bites that are full of flavor. You know, it's sort of the trick to food festivals. It's like you have one moment to just get people. And, you know, the layers of sauces, like there's salsa verde in it. There's a chili sambal in it. There's cotija cheese. The pork belly is salt chili cured overnight and then roasted and then grilled and then lacquered with gochujang, you know. So it's supposed to resemble like Chinese roasted pork, like char siu. It's Mexican, Chinese, and Korean all in one bowl.
Questions from the audience. I feel like I've been monopolizing this great panel, but I want to throw to anyone out there who might have something they want to ask. Oh, sure. I feel like I'm teaching class. No one wants to say anything. Yeah, please.
So this is a little bit of a hot topic, but as far as, you know, over the last, I think last year, we saw a lot about cultural appropriation. And so as someone who's obviously not Asian American and doesn't know anything about how that would affect me, it's hard to put myself in kind of the shoes of someone that might affect. And so I was curious as what your take on is, you know, what is true cultural appropriation and is what's the line between someone having a reverence for another culture and expressing that through food versus just straight up cultural appropriation? And what are your thoughts on that?
So we'll just be here for another hour now. Okay.
It really depends on what you're cooking. If you're cooking Filipino food, anybody can cook it. Because the knowledge of it is so, it's not as known yet. But if you're cooking, say, Chinese food or Japanese food, and everybody's going to be like, because they have more knowledge and more expectation of what you're cooking. So I guess it really depends on which culture you're cooking. That's what I say to that one. But it's, me cooking French food was definitely a little tough. And I was young. I was probably 28 when I was led that kitchen. Old people would see me and say, you're the chef of this place? You know, it hurt for a little bit, and I kind of just ran with it. All the years of me going through the kitchens, oh yeah, you're Chinese, right? Because they didn't know what Filipino was. And then I immigrated here, so I didn't grow up here. So I was like, oh yeah, this is something that I just take on for myself. And I just kind of live with it. And then finally, you know what? I'm just going to cook Filipino food and no one can tell me anything, you know? So that's kind of how I ended up in my restaurant.
But I think that you studied French food, right? So you've read about it. You've been tested on it. You've traveled. You've really just immersed yourself into the culture to be able to cook it from your perspective and add a twist to it. And I think what happens is, you know, there's no respect sometimes for the history behind very classic, you know, iconic Asian dishes. And there's no understanding or desire to understand what is the etymology of it, you know? Why does egg foo young exist? Why do bowls exist? You know, and I think that's what's missing in the conversation is we get so stuck on the politics and the back and forth and who's right and who's wrong. But to me, it's like, did they respect, you know, where this came from and why it's here and why it's evolved? Dishes need to evolve. Food has to evolve. You know, that's why LA is what it is today, is because we've got, you know, leaders who are showing and showcasing and boldly serving what their interpretation of everything they grew up eating is, you know?
I think that LA is kind of it's an oasis in a sort of way than the rest of the country. And I got that idea I asked Wes Avila of Grilled Tacos the same thing. And he's like, I don't care if the cook next to me is black or Hispanic or Chinese. If he can make a good taco, he's on my team. And I respect that. And I also, going back to what Charles was saying about flavor, I think, you know, people who are using calamansi and fish sauce and they're making pork adobo on every menu. I think in a few years, that stuff's going to weed itself out. The public is going to know what makes a good pancit versus a bad pancit. And it just takes time. That's how omakase happened. Like, we're willing to pay $200 for a sushi meal because now we know what good sushi tastes like.
I mean, if it's okay for me just to answer a question as a moderator, and I'm going to put on my sociologist hat. Ultimately, arguments around cultural appropriation are arguments about power. Who has access to the market? Who has doors open to them? Who has doors closed to them? And so long as there's a power imbalance because of the legacy of institutional racism, people are going to feel some type of way about whatever the culture is, food or otherwise, being appropriated, only because we recognize that it's not equal. And so long as that is part of the backdrop, that debate is never really going to go away. All right. One more from the audience. Yeah, I saw a hand floating in the back someplace. Yeah.
Do you want a microphone? Okay.
I'll restate. Go ahead. Unfortunately, for the Facebook Live audience, I'm not going to be able to redo that. Though I would say, as a music critic as well, that's actually a pretty good line. I'm not mad at that. But the question here is, are there problematic examples of the relationship between how Asian cuisine gets discussed or used in other aspects of pop culture?
I mean, that's a really interesting thought. I mean, when you started reciting that rhyme, I just thought of, isn't like that Migos stir fry song like the biggest thing in the country right now? So it's kind of funny. I don't know. I think hip hop reflects what's popular and what's current and I sound so old saying this. What the younger people are thinking about, you know, and whether it's like Run DMC talking about like macaroni and cheese at Christmas. I mean, I kind of like what you just said, you know. I got to hear the beat, but yeah.
I never need to see another film that involves people eating sushi off of a woman's body. I'll say that much.
True. There was a really bad film called Sushi Girl, and they were just, it was terrible.
Anything else? Frank, can I call on you? We were talking beforehand about your observation about Yelp and the black Yelpers, which is not what I thought the term meant, if I can. So the question here, or the statement, was around the observation that there seems to be a disproportionate number of Asian Americans involved in different aspects of food culture, especially online and in social media. Black Yelpers are Yelp people who have the most reviews, so they attain like black card status, basically, and they're like 90% Asian American. And so, again, what is it about this relationship?
I have no idea. But I think perhaps a lot of Asian cultures, including Japanese culture, food is really the way of connecting the family. That's the time family have conversation, and also Asian culture, we tend to share dishes, like family style. And so I think as Asian people grow up, it's naturally you are just, food is just really, really, you know, of course food is important to everybody, but the way think food is maybe a little more differently. And so you get, just naturally get, more people get passionate about food. So
I think you're so right, because we grew up training as critics, food critics, our entire lives, you know? Like, you're going to go to a restaurant as a family, you're going to know right away if it's a good restaurant and you're going to come back or not, right?
Yes. To Ken's point, how many Asians are in there, right?
Yeah. And so I actually don't mind that there is that disproportionate number, because, you know, it's an outlet. It's an outlet for us to share our opinions and something that we feel like we can be an authority about, flavor, right? Which is very subjective, but I don't know. I feel like if you're a shy kid, but, you know, you're the one thing that makes you happy is to try new food and write about it and share it with people, that's pretty cute and cool, you know? And that's like, that's a powerful moment. Despite, you know, the crap that Yelp gets, because it's awful that restaurants have to respond to and react to Yelp reviews. Like, we go through it, you know, all the time, and I hate that, you know? I think there needs to be some change there. But just the idea of giving, you know, folks an opportunity to have a platform to share their thoughts, I think is powerful.
I think that's a really good point, that I think it's also like, it's like a socioeconomic thing too, which what you're saying is, and I think, you know, whether it's a bowl of ramen or a slice of pizza or a $3 taco, any 19-year-old kid can, you know, just be a connoisseur of that. And you don't have to know what, you know, A5 beef tastes like, but you can know where the best 5 tacos in LA are. And I think that's what's exciting.
I also think Now Serving needs to have a t-shirt line that just says flavor authority on it. That sounds good. Charles, anything you want to add?
It's such a hard question. I always feel like Asians as a whole, we're always just more analytical. I went to school in the Philippines, and even within there, just the different Asian cultures in school, like, you would know who's good in math. You would know who's good in English. Like, we're just a little bit more thorough, I think, with writing these things.
We're the model minority of food is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. That's another t-shirt line idea for you right there. Okay.
All right. I'll call Joseph.
I just have one last question. This can be very brief for each of the panelists. I want you to name one of your favorite Asian restaurants that you're not affiliated with in the city. Okay, so you can't plug your own spot, but someplace that you guys like each of you like to go eat. Doesn't matter what the cuisine is, as long as it's Asian.
Tsubaki in Echo Park.
You stole my answer. Tsubaki in Echo Park, and I also love Pine and Crane. It's not a Taiwanese restaurant, it's an LA restaurant.
I grew up eating at Full House in Chinatown, and it is still my spot every time. Hot and sour soup, salt and pepper fried squid.
You gotta tell me the rest of that order.
Yeah, oh, it's intense, but that's like my spot.
For me, it would be, I don't know if it's Asian, but it's definitely Chego. It's something that me and my wife would find ourselves going back to all the time. And Shibumi. Shibumi is probably one meal in a long time where I was like, this is flavor. I came in there not knowing what to expect, and I came out, it's like, that was really good. You know, it's not an everyday restaurant, but it was fantastic.
Well, thanks to the panel. In particular, thanks to Ken and Michelle and Kimberly for really pulling this together. Ken and Michelle are expecting their firstborn any minute now, so, like, big congrats to them.
Today.
And thanks to all of you for coming out today.
Thank you to our amazing panelists and moderator. I do want to throw the question back to Oliver and ask, what's your favorite?
Oh, that's easy. It's Chego. I mean, it's still the one place where, for out-of-towners, if they want, where can I get something to eat that is unique to L.A., that's where I send them.
Thank you so much to all of y'all. Thank you so much to all of y'all for coming. I heard all the and the yeah in the audience, and I think this conversation could go on a lot longer. Thank you.
That's it for this bonus episode of Good Food. I'm Evan Kleinman, and I've been sharing highlights from Food Book Fair LA earlier this month. If you missed it, be sure to listen to last week's bonus episode featuring a panel I was on about the future of food media. Our thanks to Kimberly Chow and Amanda Dell at Food Book Fair for allowing us to share these segments. As always, thank you for listening to Good Food.